Thanks, Melinda, and good afternoon, everyone. I guess there's a bit of background there on why I'm here. I guess to sharpen that up a little bit. Over the last few years, I've been covering a lot the changing power relationships as the internet changes every level of society around us. And I gather that kind of media and power is something that you have been or will be looking at. So what I want to stress today is that, you know, there really is a revolution going on, and not just because everyone trying to sell you all of these laptops and smartphones says there's a revolution and be in it, but it is for real. And we hear a lot about how, you know, journalism is dying, the media is dying. Well, it's not dying, just certain aspects of it are dying. I mean, and there are new things being born, and that's what happens in a revolution. At the end of the revolution, things are very different from how they were at the beginning. That's kind of a definition, I suppose. But, you know, along the way, people get hurt, people get killed, institutions get killed, and so on. Now, against that background, we've got the topic today, algorithms and the filter bubble, is the supplied title. What I will say, though, just quickly, some housekeeping. Let's keep this informal. I'm going to be cruising through notes and showing you a few pictures. I'm certainly not going to show you slides that just repeat the words of what I'm saying. I assume you can listen for yourselves or have someone who can help you with that. Please feel free to ask me questions. I will be asking you some questions as we go along, because I don't get much of a chance to find out how people are facing the interesting challenges and issues as they come up. I am recording this, so within the next few days at my website, and you'll see the address at the end, I'll be posting the full audio and transcripts with links to all of my sources. And I'm doing that afterwards because I figure we might kind of make up a few things as we go along and go, where did I get that fact from? Or check the transcript as well, because I'll correct anything if I misspoke. If you ask a question and for whatever reason you don't want your voice to be on the final recording, that's fine. The safe word is penguin. Just make sure you use the word penguin and your voice will not be in the final published recording. Okay, algorithms and the filter bubble. I assume, of course, you read every word of the pre-reading in great detail, as students always do. So I'll just flick through that quickly and say, look, an algorithm is just a procedure for solving some kind of mathematical or information problem. It's a recipe, if you like, but a recipe that's so mechanical, if you like, that you can program a computer to do it. So there was a paper all about that, but we're going to hear a bit in the first half of this about how algorithms are being used in the production of news today. The second part there, well, we'll get to that. Algorithms in the news. Two ways that this is happening. One is choosing the news for you. Now, who uses Google News at all? Hands up. I'm seeing maybe 5% if we're lucky. Okay. Google News, just news.google.com.au, allows you to choose the balance of stories that you want. At a superficial level, you can say, I don't want sport, I do want entertainment, I do want technology, or vice versa. At another level, you can say, hey Google, use what you know about me to show me news that you know I'm interested in. And Google has a lot of information about you. I'll come back to that, because it's actually a lot more than you realise. So you can, using resources like that, instead of having just what the Sydney Morning Herald tells you and says, well, this is the editor's choice, you have your own choice of what's important. The second part of that, actually, no, I won't jump ahead to that yet. I'll talk about the other part of this news being chosen for you, is how news production is absolutely driven by the numbers these days. In the days of newspapers, you just knew how many people bought the newspaper. and you guessed that because there was a story about the death of the Queen on the front page, that 100,000 extra people bought the newspaper that day because of that. These days, of course, they're measuring every single story that you click in online, and they know exactly which stories work and which don't. And the online outlets, particularly those that have begun online, are the ones pushing the boundary on this. Huffington Post, in the US, for example, actually does what's called A-B testing on their headlines. When a journalist files a story, they or a sub-editor will provide at least two different headlines for it. And they are shown randomly to visitors to the website. As soon as they figure out which headline is performing better, that becomes the headline for the story. Totally automatically. Now, combine that with the fact that a lot of these content farm journalists are just re-churning news out very quickly, and they're paid according to how many click-throughs there are to their story. So, as a question for you to think about later, what does it mean for news values when the entire mechanism is about how quickly you, like a monkey pressing the button to get the lolly, choose which stories you're going to read? Surprisingly, or perhaps not surprisingly, have a look at the kind of most read stories on those kind of websites, and yet they're not shrinking. Those sites are growing. The other thing that's really interesting, I find, though, about the algorithms is that robots are already writing the news and have been for several years. Have a look at companies like Narrative Science or Automated Insight. They are, and have for several years now, offered a service to provide news on certain highly structured areas which are completely and utterly automatic. The areas so far have been business, and particularly movements in the stock market, and sport, which is kind of the same thing. It's a series of numbers, and you can infer from those numbers and the timing some sort of narrative. Now, Narrative Science is the big player here, and this is what in the business, in the IT business, is called a marketecture. It supposedly explains how it works, but it's really generated by the marketing department. Here's Quill, which is Narrative Science's product, and really this tells you nothing. It tells you that they receive data. I love this line, builds an appropriate narrative structure to meet the goals of your audience. I don't know what that means. I suspect they don't know what it means either. The story comes out and you are delivered insight. How it kind of works in reality is that they just have computer programs watching movements on the stock market. Now, if a mining company that was previously trading at $5 suddenly one morning starts trading at $7, that's a sudden movement. The software detects that and fills out a story, if you like, according to the template. Shares in Freddo Mining this morning surged to $7 after an overnight low of plug in the number. This follows recent, I don't know, pull out the last three headlines of stories about this mining company or the leads from them. Do a next paragraph. What's the next paragraph? It's going to compare movements in Freddo Mining with the other mining companies. It sounds like it's belittling the art of journalism, but so much journalism is absolutely driven by these standard templates. And you don't need to know anything about the mining industry, the stock market. You can be dumb as a piece of wood, but you can write this story. Here's a story from the LA Times a month ago that was completely written by a robot. It's an earthquake near LA. They have just written software that watches the routine automatic announcements from the US Geological Service. And if an earthquake is above a certain magnitude and within a certain distance of LA, there's a template which is filled out. How big was the earthquake? Where was it? Show us on a map. What time? How deep? All of this can be automated from just pulling the information out of the USGS feed. And the rest, well, it's just wrapping it up in words to make it friendly for humans. This is happening now. and the editor of the LA Times, or their database editor, which I find an interesting job title in itself, said, well, who wrote this story? He said, well, Ken wrote this story, because Ken is the programmer who set up the template and decided how it'll work. So all these stories written by Ken, there's no byline there, though, and you know, perhaps it's good that the robots aren't demanding bylines yet. Sport, I guess you can think through how that might happen. Again, you know, just listen to any sports commentary. It's a series of cliches strung together with just the current numbers plugged in. Again, computers are very good at that. And as I say, this is happening now. Flipping back to the customization of news for you, I want to flag that while this is starting to happen in the news field, a lot of the examples I'm going to give here relate to advertising, because that's really where the boundaries are being pushed. I'm going to talk a bit about data mining, and a buzzword that you're going to be hearing a lot about this year is big data, which, if I want to politicise it, big data is data about us, data about everything you do online, merged between companies, shared between companies, used to create detailed and insightful dossiers about you, and probably the data mining companies they do already know much more about you than you know about yourself. I can recommend thoroughly, for starters, an article in ProPublica earlier this month. It was called Everything We Know About What Data Brokers Know About You. But they gave examples of what is actually nothing to do with the internet. These are companies that are pre-internet, if you like. I'll flag that the examples I'm giving here are American, and there are some possible Australian differences I'll mention. But in the US, there are companies like Axiom, A-C-X-I-O-M, Equifax, Experian, Datalogix with an X at the end. Many of these companies grew out of credit reference companies. That is, when you go to a bank, say, can I have a credit card with a $10,000 limit? Yay or nay, these companies have compiled stuff about you. Now, who here has something like a Flybuys card or other supermarket loyalty scheme card? That's interesting. 10%? I reckon you're lying. I reckon there's more. Maybe you don't use it. The purpose of those is not to give you points, of course. The purpose of those is so that the shop, instead of just knowing that you bought a total grocery bill of $108, knows exactly what you bought. That information, whenever you see in a company that they are sharing their information with their partners, and then they don't list their partners, their partners are likely to be data broker companies like these. So anything you fill in, a survey, a questionnaire, a competition entry, anything that happens publicly, so whenever anyone is born, dies, gets married, gets divorced, gets charged with aggravated burglary, is found guilty of aggravated burglary, all of this public information is gathered by these companies. Hey, they just get a copy of the court records and key it all in. And as soon as you do anything that can match that to an email address, to a telephone number, to a credit card number, it all gets matched up. So these companies can already do things like, all right, give us a list of people who read romantic fiction novels aged between 25 and 35 with an income of under $35,000 a year who have looked at an advertisement for a car within the last 30 days. Now, the power of that for advertisers is pretty obvious. The way it then becomes interesting is what they can infer from all of this stuff. So, for example, they may know because they have a copy of your search history or you filled out a health insurance application form that you suffer from a certain illness or that you were searching for the symptoms of that illness online. So you have what they call, what one of these companies calls, an online search propensity for this information. let's say you went to what we'll euphemistically call a dating website, and you happen to mention, you know, does it ask the question, do you smoke, yes, no, do you drink alcohol, yes, no, do you consume drugs, yes, no. Those companies, or some of them at least, are on record or have been determined to be, again, sharing that kind of information with data brokers, who are, of course, then sharing that information back to health insurance providers or credit providers or employment check providers, if you applied to be a teacher at a private school, and so on and so forth. This, I must stress, is already happening. Now, I said Google has some really good stuff here. I mean, sure, they're recording every search you make. Who here has a Google Gmail account? Aha, now I thought we'd see some numbers. Probably about half, probably more. So you know that Google is actually reading the contents of your email to add to that profile about you. So there in the terms and conditions, they talk about how it's to better target advertising at you, but I'll come back to that. Who doesn't have a Gmail account but sends email to a friend who does have one? Cool. Your email to them is in their Gmail and is also being read by Google. Hope you never talk about anything private or illegal. Should I mention at this point that the CIA has an investment arm called InQtex, which was an early investor in Google? I'll be panning out tinfoil hats later. I should say that there's nothing new there. Every intelligence organisation in the history of everything has been into everything. Who here has an Android phone? Excellent. Google knows where you are at all times. Your location is tracked. Who has an iPhone but uses Google Maps? Yeah, you too. If you use your internet connection at home, then again, your IP address has been mapped out. And perhaps if not directly, who here has a Wi-Fi access point at home? Excellent. Google Street View cars and two or three other competing organisations have driven all the streets in this city and mapped out the location and IDs of all of those wireless access points. So if you're... Yes?
So you're possibly working for
Apple? I am not working for Apple. I'll come back to Apple. Actually, good question. I just happened to pick Google because they're there. Apple is doing the same. Apple's location services are there. So everything I've said here applies as much to Apple as to Google, except that Google happens to be a lot further ahead in the game. Apple was too busy, you know, selling you gadgetry and becoming the richest corporation in the history of the universe. They were busy. What else can I scare you with? Well, we've already tracked you. We already know what you've bought. We already know at exactly what time you used your internet banking website. Oh, who will have installed apps on their phone? And the apps have ads in them. Excellent. The ad company that puts the ads in that phone, they also know your location and what time you woke up and everything and whatever. So... the genie is out of the bottle, but I think the really fun one here is Facebook. It's going to be easier to ask the other way around, isn't it? Who does not have a Facebook account? I've got one hand up, and there's perhaps three or four in the whole room. Okay, and that's fine. That's normal. The world runs on Facebook now. More Australians have a Facebook account and organise their social lives through Facebook than do not. Facebook, of course, knows an awful lot about you. Facebook knows a lot more about you than what you may realise, because whether you are currently logged into Facebook or not, every time you visit a website that has a Facebook like button on it, whether you choose to press that button or not, Facebook knows about it. Who does know what the word cookie means? Cookie. Cookie, in the internet context, not in the, you know, shouldn't have one after lunch context. Okay, I'll run through it very briefly. A cookie is a fundamental part of internet technology. It's a little bit of data that a website can leave on your computer in your web browser so that when you come back to that website later, your browser will say, oh, here's the cookie you left last time. Now, it was originally designed so that, for example, you preferred your website to be in French rather than English, it would store that fact in the cookie. So when you came back, here's my preference. I want it to be in French. I want the colours to be red, whatever it might be. Increasingly, though, what is put into the cookie is just a big long ID number. So your user number 123456789, etc., as far as that website's concerned. And so each time you come back to that website, it knows it's you. So imagine you walk into a store, and before you even looked at anything on the shelf, they get a sticker and put a number on your back so they know what you're doing as you go around the store. Now, that's fine, except websites do not exist in isolation. Here is thewest.com.au. This is their homepage this morning, the key news website in Western Australia. Now, I put a subtle red arrow on there pointing to the fact that they're part of the Yahoo network. You'll also notice, though, that there are sort of ads on that page. And there may be other bits and pieces on that page as well. They happen not to have a Facebook like button. But everything that is pulled into that page from elsewhere on the web, like that Clean Heat gas ad and so on, also can put a cookie on your computer. And that means that when you go to another website that has stuff put in there by this third party, they know that fact too. So I had a bit of a look, and this may not be totally up to date because I did the poking around in the source code a few months ago. But just by visiting that web page, not only do Yahoo 7 know about it because it's their website, the parent Yahoo company knows about it, as do Google through their DoubleClick advertising network. That's one of the largest advertising brokerages on the internet. Nielsen, who you would have obviously heard of for radio and TV ratings, they have Nielsen Net ratings as well and do profiles. Every now and then you might visit a website and it pops up, hey, what did you think of the website and how old are you and what postcode are you in? That's so they can kind of match their cookie's ID number with just further information about you and slowly add up this stuff. Right Media and iBlaster are also advertising targeting firms. Now, as an experiment, you might like to install, if you don't already use it, the Firefox web browser, because there's a wonderful little plugin called Collusion, C-O-L-L-U-S-I-O-N, that will actually track all these relationships and do a nice little diagram for you as it goes along. So there's one that started off, I think I visited maybe three or four websites there, maybe five. And while it's difficult to see on the scale, LinkedIn knows about it, Google knows about it, various ad networks do and so on. And if this was a live version of the plugin, you could just roll over each of those little dots and it would tell you who they were and provide information about them. Now, usually at about this point, someone says, aha, I have a cookie blocker in my web browser, or I have an ad blocking thing, or I have other technology to try and defeat that. That kind of works, except that you don't actually need the cookie to uniquely identify a computer, at least, if not a user. It turns out that the web browser you have, the unique combination of plugins in your web browser and which times they were installed and so on and so forth is pretty damn close to a unique fingerprint of your computer as you hit a website. So even without cookies, it's generally possible for a website to go, aha, that's that person. And in any event, if you actually want to log in and use any of the services that these places provide, well, you've got to log in. You therefore have to kind of link your identity across all of these things. Now, to put some scale on this, the Wall Street Journal a few months back studied about 1,000 leading websites. 75% of them had some sort of third-party code in them from one of the social networks, Facebook or whatever, often for a like button, sometimes to provide the whole login system. They also discovered that they looked at about 70 popular websites, And they found that generally about a quarter of the time, let's say you go to the... I don't know whether Fairfax does this with the Sydney Morning Herald. So let's say random newspaper publisher F. You log in to use their features. About a quarter of the time, your login name is also being passed on to the people who embed code in that website. So again, you might think, well, I'm not logged into Facebook or I don't use Facebook, but it doesn't matter. The fact that you're logging into website X and this is your username and email address, that kind of gets passed along anyway about a quarter of the time. Okay, this is good. I've written down midway reality check, and that's where we're up to, midway. So how many of you, I'm guessing a lot of you want to be journalists, yes? Many, I'm seeing lots of nods. How many of you are already regularly writing or reporting for anyone, anything, yourself? Few, okay. How many of you use Twitter regularly? Excellent. How many of you are tweeting what I'm saying? Excellent. How many of you have been rude about it? Good. I wanted to throw in a few snippets about how the craft of journalism is changing, because the technology press is right at the leading edge of expecting, you know, insanely fast turnaround and so on. Generally, if I were, say, a technology vendor or Stephen Conroy or Malcolm Turnbull talking about the National Broadband Network or something like that, you would, in the IT press, be expected to have your story finished and filed within 10 minutes of me finishing speaking. And you would likely have been, if not tweeting fragments of it, assembling a summary as it went along. And I did see Gus Kidman from Lifehacker? Gizmodo, one of the two, same family of publications. He, in fact, had finished his story on a speech by Malcolm Turnbull before the applause at the end had finished. That's kind of the pace at which it's going. But I leave with you, what does that imply for the depth of analysis in a story like that? And whether that's something we want. Now, back to the wonderful world of data mining. And again, this is about advertising, but I promise I will come back to talking about news at the end. Target in the United States is probably the world's leader at doing this stuff. So much so that there's a book about them coming out by a New York Times journalist whose name escapes me, but will be in the transcript. And he's been publishing some of his work as he goes along. He's now known by face to all of Target security people and is not allowed on premises. Target knows with an 85-ish% accuracy rate when a woman has become pregnant just by looking at her shopping list. And it's not as silly as it might sound, because a pregnant woman is liable to move to an unscented body lotion rather than a scented one. Certain vitamins or minerals will start to turn up in the shopping list. There'll be a dietary change. There'll be really a giveaway if, you know, booties and bonnets and baby stuff starts being bought. But they know this straight up. As soon as she knows, they know from the shopping list. To the point now where they will actually then start sending that person appropriate coupons and vouchers and special deals relating to being a new mother. And they know from their past record, and this is where the flyby and other such cards come in handy, they know from that woman's previous purchase history which promotions are likely to get her to buy, whether it's the 2-for-1 or whether it's enter a competition or whatever. So they kind of know the habits. They also know from hard experience that you can't just suddenly start sending a woman baby stuff ads, because it's a little bit creepy. And they got caught out badly by the father of a 15-year-old girl who went ballistic when this happened, except he then had to phone them back and apologise 2 weeks later, as he said, quote, there were things happening in my household that I didn't know about. So what they also do is make sure that in amongst the custom-printed catalogue and bunch of coupons going to that woman, there's also some ads for power tools and home renovations and other stuff as camouflage for the fact that they actually know she's pregnant. MIT did some lovely research. They can tell by the pattern of friend formation on Facebook whether a young man is gay or not before he knows himself. I am now running on reserve power. Turn it on, works better. Sorry about that. Who has ever filled out a questionnaire online? A fun little questionnaire. What sort of dog are you? What sort of tree are you? You know, something like that. And you fill a few, you know, 8 or 10 questions and it says, oh, you're a German Shepherd or you're a Pekingese or something. Anyone ever done that? Yeah, they've kind of gone out of fashion a bit. I suppose because people do it for themselves on Facebook now. But a few years ago, they were all the rage. They're actually a psychological profiling test on your decision-making styles. Do you rush into a decision? Do you tend to read and make a decision later kind of thing? But they would always pop up, oh, put in your email address and we'll email you the results. Well, right, they've now cross-matched that with your email. And they would often say, oh, and if you copy and paste this HTML code into your website, you can show that, hey, I'm a bull terrier. And once they've done that, well, now they've not only matched your identity to your website, they kind of get extra information. They now know when anyone visits your website, and that all goes into the big data mining operation. Now, I did want... No, I'll skip ahead. Let's look to the future of this. Frederick Filloux, F-I-L-L-O-U-X, so I probably pronounced his name incorrectly, one of the two French thinkers on this at a blog called Monday Note, he sketched out a not-too-distant scenario where you can imagine that before anyone is employed, they consult someone who has access to all sorts of data, and they discovered that, gee, this particular prospective employee, we've noticed that about once every 3 weeks, her pattern of tweets on Twitter changed to much shorter tweets and much more abrupt language with gaps of more than 3 hours between them when normally they might be a different pattern in the day. This is associated with migraine headaches. Did she mention migraine headaches? You sure you want to employ her? Also, according to our data mining, she's at a particular point in her emotional cycle, at her particular stage of life development, where there's a 75% chance that she will marry within the next 2 years. You are going to offer her a 3-year contract, are you sure? Now, that's only a little bit into the future, because there has already been research, and this is one I may not be able to find the link for, because it appears to have disappeared. But around 10 or 15 years ago, there were some researchers looking at linguistic analysis and the patterns of language used in news reporting about tense political situations. And these researchers found that by looking at the word usage, they could predict 6 weeks ahead of time whether a situation was liable to end up in a violent riot or revolution or coup, as opposed to just being, you know, a bit of rowdy politics. I remember reading a couple of articles about that in New Scientist, and then the whole thing went dark. So I can't imagine, again, who might be interested in that sort of data. Penguin? Who would run for politics anymore is the question. This is an interesting thought. Who here has watched the series The Thick of It about politics? Thoroughly recommended. It's kind of to this century what Yes Minister was to last century in terms of how politics worked. Again, in one episode, a prospective candidate for Prime Minister of Britain had to be rejected because she had an online gambling habit. She went to poker sites to play poker and she used her real name. In fact, you don't have to use your real name. This can be figured out. And it raises that interesting question. In an era when politicians are expected to have absolutely no flaws or have never done anything bad in their lives ever, I mean, just think back through your own lives. How long does it take you to flip back to think of anything that's happened in your life that, if taken completely out of context, would be embarrassing. We've all said stupid things. It's somewhat. And in fact, Cardinal Richelieu, who ran a little comedy outfit called the Spanish Inquisition, he actually had a famous line. He said, "Give me six lines written by the most honest man in the kingdom and I will find a way to hang him." You don't even have to have the six lines now. There's 6 million. It's an interesting power relationship. And again, another one came up. Mental health. Mental health is a huge problem. Someone has searched for depression symptoms online, and there was a bit of a rowdy outburst recorded on YouTube when they were 16. That person now has, quote, a history of mental illness, to put it in tabloid terms. I mean, yes, but so does 50% of the population. Personal opinion, I think we'll probably have a generation where we have a generation of unelectable politicians, and then at the end of it, one of two things will happen. We'll either decide that none of this is any of our business, and there will be an anti-Facebook backlash, or we'll go into a new age of, yeah, everyone has problems in their lives. And it's not that many generations ago. I mean, I only found out that my father had been married earlier at his funeral. There was a whole previous marriage that I did not find out about until after he was dead. And that's within living memory, because divorce was such an incredible taboo. Now, I better get onto the other half of this, the filter bubble, very quickly. This is kind of fun. There's some research being done at Queensland Uni of Technology at their Centre for Excellence for Creative Industries and Innovation. Axel Bruns and Jean Burgess. I was going, I can never remember her name. What they've done is they've started mapping the connections between, well, they have a raw feed of Twitter coming in, and they've been mapping the connections of around 1 million Australian Twitter users, and the fine-grained detail of that shows the communications links between people, their social graph, their circle of friends. And at the middle, the most heavily connected are people talking about just the utilities in life, about Telstra, about transport, about things that affect everyone. Everyone on Twitter ends up complaining about the late train or whatever it might be. And it builds out from there into, interestingly, they noted conservative journalists are a little kind of island out there on the left that is not as well connected to the rest of society as other parts. ALP progressives, the Greens, hardline conservatives even out there. Julia Gillard as Prime Minister is a bit closer to the middle of the mesh of connections, as is previous Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. I've got to say. And then farmers kind of tend to talk amongst farmers about their work. Social policy kind of nuts at NGOs there. The social media and communications and computer ones and so on. I'll skip through these because they. If you search for that paper name at the bottom, there's a lovely 1 hour presentation with audio from Axel Bruns talking through this. It's fun stuff. Now, the mummy bloggers are there, crafts and art, food and wine is there, and beer is there. And Adelaide is this little island that only talks about food, wine, beer, and Adelaide. Make of that what you will. Bear in mind that I'm from Adelaide originally. Theatre and arts and film, and look, it goes through and there's kind of a whole island of archipelago even of people interested in Australian bands down there. But Professor Bruns makes the point that they are more likely to have connections to the fans of the same bands overseas and their genre of music than to the broader music community within Australia and so on. Now, if you've read your pre-reading, you will know that this idea of the filter bubble is this idea that during the age of mass communication, we all had the same news. We all saw the same thing because it was in newspapers and broadcast radio and so on. And that now, because we have all of these sources and all of this customization, we're all seeing different things. We're all connecting, as you see there, with different kinds of things. I think that the author there, Eli Pariser, takes an awful lot of words to get to that point, and I think he sort of overcooks the cake a little bit. I think we've always had these kind of social connections separate from the mass media. It's just that we didn't have a nice, neat map of them before. And maybe those in control of mass media thought they were more in control than they thought they were of our opinions. I don't know. That's what editors these days are starting to call a feel opinion, and is not to be trusted. But if I... Oh, look, yes, look, the Jonas Brothers and Believers are all the way down there on the bottom right. Cycling, swimming, oh, sport, yes. Get to the next diagram. Okay, if you look at what people talk about, people using hashtags on Twitter as keywords, the Queensland floods, pretty much evenly spread throughout the conceptual network. They're just the people who happen to be in Queensland and therefore affected by the floods or know someone who is. AusVotes was a hashtag used during the last federal election. Again, it's broadly spread through society, except not really amongst those who are more into music and evangelical Christianity and a couple of other things. But the AusPoll hashtag on Twitter was much more concentrated over there at the conservative end of politics, and particularly... It's irony that it's on the hard left there, but they're actually that cluster there, the brightest spot or the darkest spot, is the hardline Christians and what Axel Bruns described them as. He said they're the most active on this particular political hashtag as being a little cluster of hardline conservatives identified by their anti-leftist self-descriptions, who are in turn more connected to conservatives and journalists and commentators identified as conservative than to the main nexus of political thought and opinion in the middle. And there was another example of that this week. Did anyone see the news that the Tea Party in the United States is black banning watching Fox News now because Fox News is too left-wing for the Tea Party? Now, before... I must stress, that if that sounds like I'm picking on the right-hand end of the political spectrum, exactly the same applies at the other end. So we then have those, you know, being fans of WikiLeaks... None on the far left of the graph, where you see where the conservative Christian, the conservative politicians were, and the others, they don't talk about WikiLeaks at all. And these threads are fascinating to work out. So, just to kind of wrap that up, I just want to leave you with some questions. What does it mean when people have differing that different view of the world and yet are trying to get a consensus about running the country? What does it mean for producing media? And I'll put in brackets, I don't think anyone knows the answer to that yet. I want to throw in a line. Not working for Apple, you'll not agree with the next one. Steve Jobs, when he was still alive as boss of Apple, was criticised by a writer at Gawker called Ryan Tate, because there's such control over what will actually be sold through the Apple App Store and through their process. In fact, it's impossible to get anything that's more than about an MA15 rating through, to use American terms. And in fact, when they were picked up on this, this essentially meant that you know, is Steve Jobs is also a board member of Disney trying to Disneyfy the whole internet? And Steve Jobs said that the iPad would provide freedom from pornography. Now, there's plenty of people who will support that viewpoint. You know, worried parents and immoral crusaders amongst them, but certainly many other people as well. But what if it becomes freedom from a particular economic theory that they don't like, and so on, a particular political thought? And combine a few of these other threads. What happens when a media producer knows what your bubble of interest is, knows what kind of dog you are in the sense of what kind of processes will get you to change your mind, knows where you live, knows everything dirty about you, knows how, as I say, knows how to persuade you, and knows that by and large, if they write stories in a particular way, then they will get into your filter bubble and influence you, and you may not even know it's happening. I have zero answers to this. I just find it's interesting that the mechanisms are being set up. I've called it in one article the Facebook experiment, but we really shouldn't pick on Facebook because every player is gathering all of this data and gathering it way ahead of our ability to know what to do with it and to know what it will do to us. So it's an interesting landscape. Welcome to it. Thank you.
So do we have any questions for Still at all? Very provocative lecture at the back.
You seem like someone who's really cautious about what you do on the internet, but you're really active on Twitter. Aren't you worried that that's somehow leading a really obvious trail of what you like on your life?
The question was, I seem cautious about all this stuff, and yet I'm very active on Twitter and very public, if I can summarise that, and do I worry? There are two levels, two or three things to mention quickly. One is that the privacy equation for Twitter is very, very easy to understand. Either I've said it publicly or I haven't said it. With Facebook, and the reason I don't have a Facebook profile, is they're constantly shifting and changing the rules, and I don't think that's an ethical way to behave, my opinion. Another aspect is that what I'm putting onto Twitter is pretty much what people can already find out about me, and there's an awful lot I don't put out on Twitter. And there are gaps, and there are misdirections, and some of the overheard comments I find amusing are not posted at the time I hear them, but hours or days later. So there's a little bit of misinformation coming from me there. In terms of personal safety, it's actually better if someone knows where I am, because then if I go missing, they can come and find the corpse or call an ambulance. I suspect I'm being naive. I suspect someone has that dossier ready to get me now. I don't know. Does that answer the question? Thanks.
Okay, any other questions?
Yes, sir. Back.
Just wondering, going back on to how
infiltrate is a strong word, but yes.
They can view. Yep. Do you think anywhere in the foreseeable future this will come in? Say, for example, a criminal talks on their Gmail account to another criminal about an illicit activity. Do you think that could come into a legal case?
Well, very similar things are already happening. Certainly, internet communication is something that can be got under a search warrant. There is a current thing in Australia called the National Security Inquiry, where the law enforcement and spook agencies are asking for similar powers they had with the telephone. They need a warrant to record your phone calls, but they can just ask Telstra or whoever for essentially what's on your phone bill, who you called and when and how, and the mobile phone, that includes location. They are now asking for the same warrantless access to what communications you did online. This is a live political topic right now. But last week before, the murder trial in Melbourne started against the guy alleged to have killed journalist Jill Maher. A key piece of evidence in the trial is that the location records of her mobile phone from the time she disappeared to where she was buried match this guy's mobile phone location record. And they've also got him going through a toll gate on a freeway. His car pinged that time, and that's when that phone went through that toll gate, and he was one of the X number of cars within X seconds of that. This stuff's already happening.
Okay, we have time for one more question.
Yes. I think the question is, do I think there should be or will there be government regulation on this sort of thing? Personal view, it will happen. There's one key fact that I didn't mention, but the Privacy Act is currently under review in Australia at very early stages. The existing Privacy Act has a concept of PII, personally identifiable information, which has traditionally included your name, date of birth, your street address, your email address, and so on, stuff that can identify you. There is academic research, primarily from the US, which shows, in fact, if you have enough pieces of any information, you can identify a person. You may not know their name, but you know that that's the 35-year-old nurse who does night shift at this hospital who has a 6-year-old daughter that she drops off to childcare in this suburb each week and drives a certain kind of car. There's only going to be one person like that in a city. And I know that the Privacy Commissioner is aware of that research. Where it goes, it's up to the politicians, so I'm sure they'll sort it all out perfectly for us.
Please, again, thanks to Gary for coming along.
Thank you very much. Thank you.